This is The Think Tank, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. With Dr. Mike O'Neill and hosted by Mike Russell. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Okay, Mike O'Neill here, along with Holiday Moore, ace reporter from KTAR. Our guest in this segment, Supreme Court expert, former Supreme Court law clerk, and former ASU law dean Paul Bender. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Mike. Nice to be here.
Well, you were inevitably going to be called by us this week because the big news of the week, other than presidential primaries, which were certainly big enough, the president nominated Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court.
Right.
And we're going to talk later on the whole politics of this, but there is one aspect of this which I think you are uniquely qualified to enlighten us on, and that is let's forward roll this, and let's assume that by whatever political sequence, let's assume that this man is confirmed to the Supreme Court. We have a court that is by a lot of measures divided 4-4. Where does he fit in on the spectrum of the existing judges, and specifically with respect to any of the big issues that you think are likely to be before the court in the next several years?
Yeah, I'd start with the fact that clearly if he were confirmed to fill Scalia's seat, the court would become a more liberal court. He's clearly would take what people think is a liberal position much more than Scalia ever did. Scalia hardly ever did that at all. So Scalia was a solid member of the right wing of the court, which had four people on it before Scalia died. Merrick Garland would not be that. He would probably be on a liberal to conservative scale, somewhere to, I would think, closest to Justice Kennedy, and probably a little bit more liberal than him. So what you would have is a court with three solid conservatives, the same four liberals, moderate liberals who are on there now, and Justices Kennedy and Garland as kind of swing votes.
That's interesting. I expected you to say he'd sort of become the swing vote. You'd see
Kennedy
as more
sort of the swing vote now. Although Kennedy for years tended to side with the conservatives about twice as often as with the liberals. Last year he did exactly the opposite. Garland, I would think, would be a swing vote in the image of Kennedy last year. So the two of them would be in the middle. I would think between the two of them, probably more likely to join with the liberals than with the conservatives. So it would turn a court that was dominantly conservative into a court that's dominantly liberal.
Dominant. That's strong. Not swing, but dominantly?
Well, because you have Kennedy, you have four liberals there, and you have all they need is a fifth vote, and they need one of the two of them.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, Paul, this is Holiday Moore, do you think that the hot issue for the Supreme Court and the conservatives is the abortion issue? Is that what they're really pinning this on, or more towards things like the guns and the affirmative action?
Are you talking about the court or the people who observe the court?
The people who observe the court.
Well, I'm not clear what they're most concerned with. For a while, it looked like they were most concerned with getting Obamacare held unconstitutional. Then it looked like they were most concerned with stopping same-sex marriage from being constitutionalized. Right now, I don't know whether abortion is a big thing with them or not. It doesn't seem to be. There's very little discussion about abortion in the presidential debates. Guns, you hear Cruz talking about, we need somebody like Scalia on the court to safeguard our right to guns and to safeguard our political liberty. I don't understand what he's talking about there, because the court has held that there is a right to have guns, and also that there's a right of governments to regulate it. And I don't think that position is going to change one way or the other. Scalia wrote the opinion which said that there was a broad right of the government to regulate guns.
Wasn't that a reversal of an appellate court decision in which he participated? I saw the only attack that I saw on him on a substantive matter was on the issue of guns. There was a National Review piece put out yesterday that said he had voted to uphold the D.C. ban on guns.
You know, I don't know that for a fact at all, but I was just reading in the newspaper what seemed to me to be the opposite, that the Court of Appeals panel of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals struck down the ban on guns. No, maybe upheld. Maybe you're right. Upheld the ban on guns, and he voted to hear the case in bank. That's not a vote one way or another on the issue. That's just a vote to have the full court consider what was a very important issue. So I wouldn't take it from that that he's pro-guns or anti-guns at all.
Do we have any clue of where he has come down on? Has he, for example, ever weighed in on the issue of abortion in any respect?
I don't know. I've read some of his opinions. I certainly haven't gone back and read them all. I don't remember an awful lot of, in fact, I don't remember any specific opinion that he wrote that was really controversial.
There's nothing I could find as well. I don't know if there is one that exists.
That is one of his strengths, I think. He does not write controversial opinions. He tries to get to positions that are really very well supported in logic and experience and precedent. And when he writes an opinion, it's usually so persuasive that it's very hard to be controversial about it. To me, that's maybe his best strength. I think he would, if he gets on the court, he would help the court enormously because he would begin to be the seed for a central moderate group on the court, which the court hasn't had. They've had four on the left, four on the right, and Kennedy and sometimes O'Connor in the middle. The court really needs a group of people in the middle who you can't predict how they're going to vote on these controversial issues, who will be thoughtful about these issues, who don't come in with pre-arranged ideas of what they want to do. And I think Garland is such a person, and I think Kennedy is somewhat such a person. And the two of them, and maybe one or two other people now there, Justice Kagan perhaps, Justice Sotomayor, can begin to be a central block on the court, which will break down these two right-wing and left-wing blocks that have really, I think, been bad for the court over the last 15 or 20 or 20 years.
It's interesting. I've seen two attacks on him. One was this National Review piece, which took specifically on the gun issue. And then I've heard some liberals who are upset that they're saying that he's a centrist and we want a liberal.
Well, they can say that. I don't know what particular thing they're afraid of him on. I think the one thing that liberals would probably tend to be most concerned about, he has a career as a prosecutor. He was a very good prosecutor, and he's a very effective prosecutor. And he's also a prosecutor who really respects constitutional rights. But I think he would tend to be maybe less favorable to criminal defendants in some issues than perhaps Justice Sotomayor or Justice Kagan. But even there, they are not. There's nobody in the current court who is a really strong liberal in the as, for example, Thurgood Marshall or Brennan was, or maybe Chief Justice Warren. There's nobody like that on the court now at all. They're moderate liberals, and I think Merrick Garland would be a little bit more moderate than them, but generally a moderate liberal as well. And so what I was saying before is I think he would make a court composed of five moderate liberals, one conservative who sometimes votes with liberals, that's Kennedy, and three very staunch conservatives. That's a big change. The court has, in the last 15 years or so, been four very conservative people. A Kennedy in the middle who agreed with them two out of three times or three out of four times, and then a minority of moderate liberals. Garland's being on the court, I think, would change that to a court dominated by the moderate liberal group.
Interesting. And if I am reading you correctly, might be the kernel of an emerging sort of centrist bloc on the court.
Right, which is something the court really, really needs. He's somebody who can talk to both sides. And if anybody can get people like Alito and Thomas and even Roberts to come to a meeting of the minds with people like Breyer and Ginsburg on the other side, it would be Merrick Garland, because they all respect him and they all know that he does not come with an agenda. that he wants to get everything right and that he's very measured and very thoughtful. So he's somebody I think people will listen to. Whether he wants to do that on the court is something else again. He clerked for Justice Brennan, who is a master of getting court members together to form majorities to do things Brennan wanted them to do. I don't think Merrick's personality is like that, but it might develop into that. And so he could be the leader of a centrist group, which I think the court really needs.
Well, thank you very much, former Dean Paul Bender, ASU Law School, and former Supreme Court law clerk. You've been there, and you're the go-to guy on this. I thank you very much for your perspectives. When we come back in the think tank, we will discuss the politics of this and the likely scenarios that may occur in the various political machinations on this issue. We'll be back in a minute in the think tank, KTAR News.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we're back in the think tank. Mike O'Neill here, along with Holiday Moore.
Hello.
And we did this a little bit out of order because I wanted to get Paul Bender when we could get him, because as you saw, nobody can speak to the likely judicial temperament and philosophy of somebody who hasn't gone to the Supreme Court yet as well as Paul Bender.
Well, I mean, Paul Bender, if you look at his resume, he should be nominated at least sometime in his career. He's in his 80s now, but I'm surprised in the past, perhaps he has been asked and he's declined, but it's a professor in Pennsylvania. He's been a professor here at Arizona State since the mid-80s.
Well, eminently qualified. And the people who really know, I think, can speak to the number one of all that long list of things was the fact that way back when he was a Supreme Court clerk. In other words, those are the folks who sat on the inside.
About Garland was a Supreme Court clerk.
Most of the justices who get appointed to the Supreme Court were at some point a clerk on the Supreme Court.
Well, and that happens in many, many arenas. In our business, you are an intern at CNN before you are hired at CNN. It's almost always the way it works in higher professions.
Well, you get to be a Supreme Court law clerk by being the best of the best. Now, to get on the court itself, that's where politics comes to play. And what's going on, and this is a good segue into the politics of this, is you have a court right now that's roughly evenly divided. The president, I think, instinctively would have pulled somebody more to the liberal side, but he had to engage in a calculus. And what he chose, I think, is somebody who's so unassailable and so centrist. His calculation is, I will force the Republic. This guy is so down the road that the only way they can refuse to confirm him is to appear to be extremely partisan and petty.
Now, therefore, they force the hand.
But there's a calculus going on. And in other words, I think so the president nominates somebody who by most things is centrist, maybe, you know, slightly on the liberal side, but enough centrist that his vote will not be predictable. The Republicans say we're going to stall it because we think we're going to get one of our guys as president. As we get into October, if this election looks like it's going to be a Hillary landslide, my prediction is they will confirm him so fast your head will spin, because they would be afraid that if Hillary gets elected to the presidency, that she will pull somebody who is very much a liberal on the court.
Well, they're actually saying that at the White House, they've already received GOP visitors as of yesterday, as soon as the nomination was announced, that have said prior to the election, or at least if Hillary is elected and before the new president takes office, if that were to be.
You know, that's the point at which I think the reasonable protocol of the president would be. Okay, the Republicans all along have been saying, look, let the people decide. If they have decided on Hillary, it is at that point that I would expect that President Obama would pull the nomination. Out of deference to a president who was just elected, as opposed to somebody almost a year out. You know, he's president for the whole year. But this is, as one observer pointed out, on matters of procedure, everybody is a hypocrite in Washington. You'll notice you can dig back to past quotes when the situation reversed, and everybody involved in this is making precisely the opposite nomination. This is hardball politics. Both the Democrats want to get somebody more on the liberal side. The Republicans want the conservatives to completely own the court, and they're all calculating how they can do it. The Republicans say, if we win the presidency, which is always a possibility, we get our guy. But there's other dynamics. For example, there is a 3-vote right now Republican majority on the Senate. If Donald Trump is the nominee, and it looks like he's going down badly, Mitch McConnell has already met with some of these senators to devise strategies whereby they can distance themselves from Donald Trump in order to preserve their Senate majority. So the presidency's at stake, but we're very much in a touch-and-go situation with respect to the status of the Senate as well. So everybody's gaming. And I would expect you to see, okay, so he nominated somebody right down the center, and the Republicans are holding out for somebody on the right. If it looks like they're going to be facing a Hillary choice, watch them cave.
Yeah, I don't doubt it. I can't wait to see what happens when we hit November.
Watch the polls. You know, Trump looks like likely at this point. And if he gets that nomination, well, we'll talk about all of that in the next segments.
There's
the possibility of a very fractured Republican Party.
That's all next on The Think Tank.
The Think Tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we've dealt with the Supreme Court. 30 minutes, and now you know everything you need to know about the Supreme Court. I predict more to come on that one.
Yeah, and I don't know if we know everything we need to know, Mike.
I think we know about as much. I mean, I saw you did this as well, scoured the web trying to look for information on decisions that this fella has made. It's interesting how he just happens to have not been involved in the kind of hot button stuff. There's no seminal abortion ruling or something like that, which predictably would get half of the votes against him, no matter which way he went.
And that would have come in his earlier years, because that's when he was writing his papers while he was on Law Review.
Well, that too. But 19 years on the appellate bench, that's, as you pointed out, that is way up there in terms of experience. And the reason is there's been a concerted attempt, mostly by Republicans, to put on people that are very young so they'll stay there for a long time. Democrats have been less successful. You notice he is 63. That's the age of all these other justices who have been there for 10 or 12 years already.
And we asked Paul off mic, you know, what do you think when you hear that people are calling him old at 63?
Well,
and he kind of scoffed at that because
as he pointed out, at 63, on average, you'll probably get 20 years of service. But at 43, you might get 40 years of service.
And therein is a locked mindset that if the Republicans or the Democrats win, they would feel their opinion is represented for the next 40 years.
You know what? If it weren't for the fact that all of this has been politicized, there would be an easy and obvious solution to this issue. And that would be a constitutional change that says when you appoint somebody to the Supreme Court, it is for a fixed 20 or 25-year non-renewable term. And that would take away – then all of a sudden you'd see more 60-year-olds being appointed, because they'd say they're going to serve the same length of time regardless. We're going to just select the best person. We're not going to game to get somebody who's real young hoping that they will stay on the court for 40 years, which I think people can argue 40 years is probably a bit much.
So has anybody ever proposed that as a possible bill in Congress?
Oh yeah, but it's more than a bill. It's a constitutional amendment.
That's true.
And the bar for that is so high that everybody would look at that. And first of all, you'd have to exempt everybody on the court right now, or else it would be blatantly political. And whichever party was in right now would be constrained by that. They would say, doesn't matter whether it's Democrats or Republican, they would not want it to take effect during their term because they want to appoint the life. So in other words, it's a good idea that will never happen because politics will intervene, because everybody will view that through the spectrum of how does this impact my discretion. If Hillary's elected president, she would not want to only get a 20-year term for somebody when everybody else has gotten unlimited. But it's interesting that you see that when they look, you can just see it. They're trying to find people younger, but they want to get them younger, but they also have to have a decent resume, which is harder to have at 40 than it is at 60. Change of subject. In 2 days, Arizona preference primary.
Wait a minute. I want to get that clear because we keep hearing presidential preference and we hear presidential primary. We used to have a primary. Now we have a presidential preference. We were looking that up. And that is, what's the difference on that?
Well, one big difference, and I don't know that that's keyed by the word preference, is that it is closed. In other words, I'm an independent. I don't get to vote in either the Democratic or the Republican primaries. If you were an independent until about 2 weeks ago or thereabouts, you could have re-registered temporarily if you want and then voted in one party or the other's presidential preference primary. It's too late. If you're not registered as a Democrat or a Republican, you don't get to vote on Tuesday. End of discussion. Some states have the provision that allows independents to vote in the other primary. The other primary that we have is in August. That is our primary election for all other offices.
State primary.
But it includes federal offices. It's the non-presidential, which
all,
is probably
all inclusive.
It's everything else. And in that one, because of a vote of the people by citizen initiative, independents and no party preference folks can walk in to that election and may pick up the ballot of their choice.
So the other thing that's too late as of today is you cannot mail in your ballots either, because that date passed us. It was last week. So if you are planning to vote and you haven't already,
show up at the polls.
Got to go to the polls.
The old-fashioned way.
Mm-hmm.
So, but looking around, by the way, a poll come out. Frankly, the first reputable poll of anything in the state of Arizona was a Bruce Merrill poll. And I say reputable, I'm talking about somebody with a track record who polls actual using live interviewers. And by the way, including cell phones, every live interviewer poll that's of any decency now includes cell phones. I encounter lots of people say all these polls are bad because they don't include cell phones. Wrong. There are the real polls, the ones that use real live interviewers, they call cell phones. There is this whole other cast, which is the vast majority of polls that you see now, which are pure junk. They're robocalls. There's computer things. There's every which kind of thing in the world. Take them all with a grain of salt. I saw a couple of those, and I won't even say what the numbers were, because I think that's in terms of news judgment, that's irresponsible. If you know it's junk, don't report it.
Well, in full disclosure, you yourself have your company that does polling, and you've seen the arc that this polling cycle has taken over the last two decades.
Absolutely seen it. And what has happened is that, one, it's gotten harder and harder because people are more and more resistant to being interviewed. There's ways of getting around that, but they are very expensive. And now you have So you go to a news organization or somebody is sponsoring and it says, we can do this right. We can have live interviewers. We can make massive repeated calls. We can call cell phones, which have to be called manually, can't be, you know, et cetera. So all of these are contributing to cost. Or you get somebody who says, we have this actually in our profession. They call them computerized response analysis poll. So you can think of the acronym yourself. Okay. And that is the majority of what's out there because they are really fast and they are really, really cheap.
And they don't and
they're really lousy.
They're lousy because it's not a human to human context. So you don't even know if you're actually talking to
99% of people hang up on those. Now, response rates with humans are getting tougher and tougher, but they're not 99% hang up.
So who is answering that poll?
Absolute question. That's what happened. We had the worst debacle in polling history in Michigan. Every single poll that was done. and most of them were not done by the better firms. They were using these questionable methods. Every single poll that was done showed that Hillary was at least up by 20 points or more, and she lost.
Okay. Yeah,
that and I've been saying this for years. I've been saying that we are going to see some massive failure of polling. And by the way, the same applies to commercial survey research. They are being sucked in by the same seductive lure of that which is really quick and really cheap. And I predict multi-billion dollar mistakes will be made based on this false premise that you can get it quick and cheap.
Well, one of the biggest mistakes we've made, and that is, I don't necessarily believe it's robo. It was robo polling, but back in 2000, during the 2000 election, and I'm not saying it's the mistake of who got into office, so let's not politicize that for me. But what I'm saying is the mistake of it was a absolute cluster back in 2000, and that was when the newsrooms made the decision collectively. And I'm not including ABC or NPR. I'm including the other major national news chains decided, hey, it's getting expensive out there. Let's collectively do the polling together. We'll use the same polling company. And then when the results come out, we'll all have them at the exact same time. There's no competition here. Well, when they did that, they had relied on one source, and it backfired on them as far as it. And you know the details. You have a good friend who wrote a very specific book on this.
Yeah, well, I know all the folks. In fact, this has been discussion for years and years. In fact, I would quibble at one level of detail. There was one aspect. Normally, having independent sources is to be preferred. But the whole massive operation of exit polling and all, there's a whole range of data collection. They do data collection with actual votes as they're coming in so they can pull select precincts before all the votes are counted. There actually was a very good reason to consolidate the data collection part, and that is because the budget for the entire operation for four-year cycles, independent polling at all of the state-by-state in the primaries and in the general, the budget was $100 million and a four-year planning period. And no news organization anywhere in the world was capable of pulling that off. There were mistakes made, but there were other. I think actually the data collection decision, that actually was a wise one, even though I know it sounds bad, just having one operation. Well, if you could come up with another $400 million, then we could get four more replications of that. They had independent decision desks, and that's the way they decided to kind of bifurcate. One data collection operation, because it was so expensive, then all the data went independently to every single network. And every single network made their own call. But what happened was,
the producers are staring at each other.
And what happened was, there was actually in the rush of things on election night in 2000, there was one point when there was a little data entry error, and it showed a blip up in the George Bush percentage. And Fox News was the first to jump on that. And they made the call. And then the people at NBC, CBS, and CNN
mm-hmm.
looked at that and said, oh, my God, they've already called it. What do we do? And you were looking at it, and everybody saw the same blip, which turned out to be a mistake. So everybody called it. George Bush makes his
not everybody. ABC backed off.
They didn't. They
our
held
affiliation
off.
Okay. Did not.
Good call. Okay, they were all looking, but that was competitive pressure. The other guy called it, so what are we going to do? George Bush then made his victory speech, and Al Gore was riding on his way over to the convention hall
to make his concession
speech. And then the networks retracted. They said, oop, we caught this mistake. It's really slow. And by that time, the picture that was painted was that Al Gore was a sore loser. And it was a random, and I could go into greater details on this. And I commend the book, by the way. It was called David W. Moore, How to Steal an Election. But
that doesn't have some political charges to it.
Oh, yeah. And I know David is a very, very careful scholar. He's been on this show. I've known him for 25 years. I suspect the title came out of the marketing department of the publisher, because that is way more provocative than he is. We've run over here a little bit. We will be back in just a few minutes to wrap this up in the Think Tank and KTAR News.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Back in the Think Tank, Mike O'Neill here with Holiday Moore.
For Mike Russell.
We are talking about the presidential race, which is heating up in Arizona. I alluded to the Bruce Merrill poll, the only one that I trust that's out there right now. And that is just one poll in general on these. I wouldn't take any one poll to the bank, even a good one. Mm-hmm. So this is very suggestive. But what the evidence seems to suggest is what's most likely to occur in Arizona is very similar to the national figures, which is the likely victors are Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And if that is the case, and there are several states that are voting on Tuesday, but Arizona is the big enchilada among them. That's why you noticed that a multitude of candidates, almost all of them, have been here this week. And so we're about as close to the spotlight as we're going to get. Moving to kind of the national picture, I think if you look at the Democratic side, the outcome is pretty much foreordained at this point. Hillary Clinton is the nominee. Bernie Sanders probably doesn't go away because he has a point to make. And frankly, that's what he set out to do in the first place. I don't think he realistically hoped to win the nomination, but he probably got a bigger splash than he figured he would.
What do you think, Mike? I've been curious to hear your opinion on why Bernie Sanders won't do what Rubio did. You know, suspend or maybe back off and give his delegates over to Hillary Clinton.
I think that Marco Rubio was running to become president of the United States. I think that Bernie Sanders was running to keep Hillary Clinton honest on the left, to move the agenda a little bit in his direction, to get her to address issues like campaign finance, Wall Street, and things like that, that he felt she had a tin ear on. And I think that he's largely been successful in that effort. And I think what you're going to see at the convention, and so I don't think there's any reason why she wants to force him out, because he at this point is not threatening victory. He'll probably pick up a state here and there, and he will keep on the national news, but not at the level of, is he going to win the nomination? You go to that convention, there will be a Bernie night. Bernie will make a speech. There will be an enthusiastic crowd. And the only fear that she has, I think, is that will the crowd be more enthusiastic for him than they are for her? There is a possibility
that has happened. It's happened in the past already.
And the news media will be there and will be commenting on that. But I expect him on the stage. I expect her vice president on one side and Bernie on the other. That's my prediction of what happens. By the way, I have a couple of points on vice presidential picks.
I was going to ask you if you think that Bernie Sanders might actually be a choice or an obvious choice for her to go as, because he's certainly carrying the day that she's not carrying when she's not carrying it.
No, I don't.
Why is that?
Too big a target, and if she wants to go with a dramatic pick, there is a choice that would absolutely excite the Bernie Sanders crowd. And that is
Elizabeth Warren.
You got it. If she decides to be conservative, then she picks Julian Castro, one of the twin brothers from San Antonio, who is now Secretary of, I think, Transportation.
Very, very popular. Yeah. Very popular in the political
Obviously
spectrum.
Hispanic, young, you know, no skeletons in the closet. But I think at that point, that's not a dramatic pick. I think at this point, that's the conservative pick. Okay, let's move to the Republican side. Much, much more interesting.
You don't hear a lot of people admitting that they are a Trump fan, but they sure are coming out.
I guess it depends on what circles you travel.
No, I'm talking about when you ask them, they don't tell you. It's as if they know, I don't want to get into a political debate with anybody, so I am going to keep my opinion to myself. When you get in circles with real close friends and you do hear their arguments for Trump, I'm hearing more and more often they're tired of politicians being in the pockets of lobbyists.
Fair point. And interestingly, there is a little bit of crossover between the Trump and the Bernie appeal in that sense. They are both the anti-establishment folks. Now, their politics come out completely different. You know, there is speculation, though, if Bernie gotten the nomination, would he be able to, you know, pick off some of those folks? Yeah, maybe a little. By the way, discount all the polls that you see about how many people say they won't return to the fold under various candidates. Most of them will.
Or they'll run to Canada?
Not going to happen. Not going to happen. That's a measure of people being upset. But in the case of Donald Trump, they don't all, even a sliver of supporters of other candidates don't return to the fold, then that's big, big trouble. And I think we have two possible and both very plausible scenarios here. One is, I think a Clinton route is a possibility. That scenario would involve mainstream Republican leaders like Romney did, just visibly distancing themselves from him. The question is, I think at a minimum, you're going to have a whole lot of people doing what was done in 64 and 72 for Goldwater and McGovern, respectively. And they'll make a statement like, I always support the Republican nominee. You know, not even
very neutral.
Not even using his name. I do that. I'm a Republican. I always support. And if they do that, that's damning with faint praise.
It's already happening. You
know? So they're distancing. And in particular, as I pointed out earlier, McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, has already had meetings with senators trying to strategize how you can distance your Senate campaign as a Republican senator from the key states. I think are Florida, Ohio, Nevada, same old ones, you know, the swing states, mm-hmm. which currently have Republicans in there. And they're the states that the Democrats need to pick up in order to control the Senate. Here's how you can run for the Senate as a Republican, but keep Donald Trump at arm's length.
So what's going to happen with Rubio's delegates? Where are they going to go? Or are they going to be locked up for the entire race?
Different state law. Some states they're bound and others they're not. I think mostly they're free agents. And so
they can choose on their own whether they want to jump ship.
Yeah, I think there's some difference in state laws with respect that most states you're not bound more than one vote anyway. But by the way, last thought. Trump doesn't need to get 51%. He needs to get 45%. At 45% of the delegates, they will trip over one another to be the guy who puts them over the top.
And I have a funny feeling. This is cowboy country. He's going to do very well in this state because Arizonans don't like to be told what to do. And he's been saying that the whole time.
Well, and he's been doing well in a lot of non-cowboy states as well. Thank you very much, Holiday Moore. In the think tank, Mike O'Neill here. We'll be back next week in the think tank. KTAR News.